Tanvira nodded, closing her eyes briefly as if wearied by the talk.
Would you not agree that one reason the Niroda were relatively easy to defeat was they were technologically outmatched by the forces of the Imperator?
Kane's mobile mouth curved in a patronizing smile.
Define relatively easy,
Tanvira shrugged.
Losses weren't as high.
She caught herself when she saw Kane's smile disappear.
I apologize.
Get to the goddamn point, if there is one.
The point is that the Niroda are no longer technologically inferior. They've found a way to destroy the future of humankind.
How?
By the same method you've been studying to change it. Temporal manipulation.
Kane stared at her blankly, bleakly, for a long moment, then rose swiftly to his feet.
Bullshit.
She remained seated, regarding him calmly.
I am afraid it is not.
There's only one place on Earth where functional Operation Kronos tech can be found, and nobody has touched it in the last 27 years but me.
I didn't say anything about Operation Kronos. There are other methods by which to tamper with time, as you are aware.
Kane didn't reply, but he knew the girl spoke the truth. Operation Kronos, a major subdivision of the 20th century's totality concept, had been devoted to manipulating the nature of time, building on the hyperdimensional transit breakthroughs of Project Cerberus. During development of the Madtrans gateways, the Cerberus researchers observed a number of side effects. On occasion, traversing the quantum pathways resulted in minor temporal anomalies, such as arriving at a destination 3 seconds before the jump initiator was actually engaged. By studying these temporal anomalies, Operation Kronos found its starting point, using the gateway technology to develop time travel.
Are you telling me the Niroda have found a new way to travel through time?
Tanvira rose slowly, wincing at the stiffness in her limbs.
That is my father and mother's fear, not to mention that of the Consolidated Council. But it's not exactly new.
How can that be?
I'm not a physicist like my parents, but I know enough of the bare bones to grasp basic principles. According to Einstein's theory of gravity, anything that has mass or energy distorts the dimensions of space and the passage of time around it, like a bowling ball dropped on a trampoline. By circulating laser beams in the right way, by slowing them down and shooting them through anything from fiber optic cable to special crystals, they might create a similar distortion that could theoretically transport someone through the quantum field to different times.
Kane eyed her skeptically.
I've read about that theory. It's very old. As far as I know, it was never tested.
My mother claims that early Operation Kronos efforts explored a number of different methods. She was attached to Overproject Whisper. She herself created a Kronan energy manipulator, the Sloan Spatiotemporal Dissociator. You might have heard of it in your researches.
Kane knew of it, but didn't reply. Overproject Whisper was an umbrella division of the Totality concept, and one of its subdivisions was Operation Kronos, along with Project Cerberus and a few others.
She said that a device was built to test whether it was possible to transport a subatomic particle like a neutron through time. The energy from a rotating laser beam warped the space inside the ring of the light, so that gravity forced the neutron to rotate sideways. With even more energy, it was believed possible for a second neutron to appear. The second particle would be the first one visiting itself from the future.
Did it work?
Apparently.
Then why was Operation Kronos not successful until Project Cerberus made its first breakthroughs?
She smiled wanly.
Sending anything larger than a subatomic particle through time required more energy than physicists back then knew how to tap into or harness. However, if it was possible to use light to send a neutron through time, a feat that doesn't require as much energy as sending a human, it wouldn't have been long before engineers figured out a way to send a person.
Except your old man's discoveries made it unnecessary.
Pretty much, yes. But if the Niroda employ this method to find the same temporal fault lines as you claim you have, they will try to fracture them, not repair them.
She regarded him with suspicion.
At least, we were assuming you wanted to repair them.
Kane turned toward the cave.
That was the general idea. Let's get ready to move out. It's about a 3-hour hike to Cerberus. I hope you're in as good a shape as you appear to be. It's uphill all the way.
Tanvira repressed a smile and a sigh of relief. Kane hadn't made any promises, but now she detected a softening of his attitude. She had feared he might be so embittered that once he learned of her parentage, he would send her back down the mountain to find her own way to return to High River. At the very least, she could now gate back home. Under the circumstances, she figured it something of a victory. And with a distant sense of dismay, she realized she didn't find Kane quite so unappealing as before. Tanvira stumbled to a halt.
Almighty God!
Kane stood beside her, his long coat slung carelessly over his shoulder, his katana sheathed at his back. The long walk had opened up his wound, and the right side of his khaki shirt was soaked through with blood. He impatiently brushed away a few flies buzzing around it. He didn't so much as glance at Tanvira.
If it's any consolation, it is a lot worse than it looks. But you should have seen it before I cleaned it up.
He started walking again onto the plateau. On the far side, a mountain peak lifted gray stone crags and broken turrets to the blue mid-morning Montana sky. After a moment of gazing around with wide, shocked eyes, Tanvira hurried to catch up to the man as he strode purposefully toward the Cerberus Redoubt. On the far side of the plateau, the broad tarmac tumbled into an abyss. The precipice dropped 1,000 feet to a riverbed. The ragged remnants of a chain-link fence ran around the plateau. At one time, steel guardrails had bordered the rim, but only a few rusted metal stanchions remained. Very little of the original outside structure remained. Craters a yard wide and nearly twice that deep pocked the surface of the tarmac. Chunks of asphalt, metal, and other less identifiable objects were scattered around. The gutted shell of a Manta transatmospheric ship was pushed up against the rocky abutment at the base of the peak. Although the hull was overgrown with tangled vines, the burned-out wreckage of a death bird could be identified and folded within the Manta's extended alloyed wings. The rust-edged rotor vanes thrust up at 30-degree angles, giving the entire mass the look of a black windmill sinking into a quagmire. Her eyes, following the line of the slope, she saw triple rows of headstones and grave markers projecting up from the grassy covering. The markers bore only last names, and Tanvira could make only a few of them out. Farrell, Falk, Wegman, DeFore. The others were obscured by high grasses and discoloration. A broad-axled spied assault vehicle lay on its left side a few yards away, completely burned out. As they strode past it, Tanvira stooped to peer through the cracked, soot-black windshield. The charred skeleton of a human being lay within, the exposure to searing heat contorting him into a fetal position. His armor had melted down to slag and permanently welded him to the inner hull. She repressed a shudder.
It took me 20 years just to get to this point of cleanup. I'll get around to separating that poor bastard from his wag one of these days.
Kane and Tanvira crossed the plateau to the massive vanadium alloy sector recessed into the peak. It opened like an accordion, 1 6-inch-thick panel folding over another. It stood partially ajar, as it had for the past 27 years, ever since the opening battle of the Consolidation War had irreparably damaged the controls. When Cerberus was built in the late 20th century, the plateau had been protected by a force field, powered by atomic generators. Sometime during the century following Skydark, the energy screen had been permanently deactivated, so Lakesh saw to the installation of new defenses. Although they couldn't be seen from the road, an elaborate system of heat-sensing warning devices, night-vision vid cameras, and motion-trigger alarms surrounded the mountain peak. Planted within rocky clefts of the mountain peak and concealed by camouflage netting were uplinks with an orbiting Vela-class reconnaissance satellite and a commsat. For several years, Lakesh safely assumed that no one or nothing could approach Cerberus undetected by land or by air. But his assumption was proved wrong in a very big way. Kane paused at the sector, fished around in his coat pocket, and removed a flashlight.
I never did get the lights back on in this section, so watch your step.
He stepped over the threshold, the white-yellow rod of incandescence piercing the darkness. Tanvira followed closely. Kane noticed she seemed too shocked to speak, even though he was sure her father had told her about what befell Cerberus and most of its personnel on the day the combined forces of Barons Cobalt, Sumerium, Tulia, and Mandy had all converged on the mountain plateau. Constructed primarily of vanadium alloy, the redoubt contained a well-equipped armory and 24 self-contained apartments, a cafeteria, a decontamination center, a medical dispensary, a swimming pool, and even detention cells on the bottom level. The facility also had a limestone filtration system that continually recycled the complex's water supply. Painted on the wall just inside the entrance was a large, luridly colored illustration of a three-headed black hound. Fire and blood gushed between yellow fangs, and the crimson eyes glared bright and baleful. Underneath it, in ornate Gothic script, was written, Cerberus. The Cerberus Redoubt had weathered the nuke cost and sky dark and all the subsequent Earth changes. Its radiation shielding remained intact, and its nuclear generators provided an almost eternal source of power. At least they had done so until 27 years before. The image of Cerberus, the guardian of the gates of hell, represented a visual symbol of the work to which Lakesh had devoted his life. The three-headed hound was an appropriate totem for the installation that, for a handful of years, housed Project Cerberus, the primary subdivision of the totality concepts over Project Whisper. The researches to which Project Cerberus and its personnel had been devoted were locating and traveling hyperdimensional pathways through the quantum stream. Once that had been accomplished, the redoubt became a manufacturing facility. The quantum interface Matrans inducers, known colloquially as gateways, were built in modular form and shipped to other redoubts. On the few existing records, the Cerberus installation was listed as Redoubt Bravo, but the people who made the facility their home had never referred to it as such, even during the height of its power and influence following the immigration of colonists who had fled from Manetius Base on the moon. At that point in time, the Cerberus personnel included specialists in almost every field of human endeavor or science: physics, electronics, medicine, and even astronomy. Tanvira reached out and tentatively touched the illustration of the three-headed hound.
The Trimurti.
The what?
The Trimurti. In Hindu myth, it means the Trinity, the combined essence of divinity.
Her finger touched the snarling heads one at a time.
Brahma, the creator, Vishnu, the preserver, and Shiva, the destroyer. One body with the heads of three gods. Alone they could do nothing, but together they were all powerful.
One created, one preserved, and one destroyed the work of the others. Pretty much a symbol of what went on here.
Her eyes flashed with dark anger.
It's the doctrine of unity.
Yeah, I've had a little experience with it before.
Dad told me you tended to oversimplify things.
I had something of a reputation for that.
He also told me it was a pose, that you enjoyed pretending you weren't as intelligent as you really were. You did it to piss him off.
It was hard to have fun in a place like this, but I tried.
Don't try to have that kind of fun with me. I've been forewarned.
Kane and Tanvira moved carefully along the wide passageway beneath great curving ribs of metal that supported the high rock roof. Traversing the 20-foot-wide corridor was slow work due to the tons of stone and twisted metal that had fallen from the ceiling and turned the passage into an obstacle course. Kane could never walk down it without remembering the long-ago dawn when he was awakened by a series of loud explosions and rolling echoes. He recalled with unpleasant clarity how he ran out of his quarters, wearing only beard stubble, and into a choking cloud of dust and smoke that billowed in from the entrance. The entire mountain peak shuddered with violent volcanic convulsions that shook loose landslides of granite, concrete, and steel support beams. Kane remembered trying to get to the operations center when a boiling blizzard of dust and stone chips came down on him. He had turned and begun to run, but his lungs became clogged with grit. Nearly blind, succumbing to a coughing fit, he dived into the first open doorway and barely avoided being buried by the collapse of the ceiling. Domi had rendered him aid.
Kane?
Tanvira's voice brought him back to the present. He turned toward her.
What?
Do you really live here?
Kane carefully considered his words before answering. Sometimes the sense of alienation, of isolation, was sleeping within him, and then he was reasonably content to be separated from the society of those who he barely believed were his fellows. But sometimes the ache of loneliness, of futility he saw in his future, was so acute it possessed him utterly. During those periods, walking off the edge of the plateau seemed like a pretty good idea.
The rent is cheap enough.
The scattering rubble became less dense the farther they walked. By the time they reached the entrance to the operations center, the floor was fairly clean of debris. Kane fumbled for the light switch just inside the open door and turned it on. Tanvira wasn't able to bite back a gasp of dismay at what she saw. Naked light bulbs dangled from a crisscross network of wires and cords crudely affixed to the high ceiling. The vanadium alloy walls were smeared with scorch marks and perforated with bullet holes. The two people stood at the open doorway of the central control complex, the command center, essentially the brain of the Cerberus installation. A long room with high, vaulted ceilings, the walls were lined by consoles of dials, switches, and readout screens. A double row of computer stations formed an aisle, but no circuits clicked, no drive units hummed, nor did any indicator lights flash. All the consoles had been blasted into twisted masses of metal, plastic, and broken glass. Every piece of equipment had been shot, smashed, and torn. There didn't appear to be a single intact microprocessor within any of the computer casings or chassis. Through an open doorway at the far end of the center, in a separate antechamber, stood the redoubt's gateway unit. The brown armaglass walls atop the elevated emitter array housing gleamed dully. As the first fully debugged matter transfer inducer built after the prototypes, it served as the basic template for all the others that followed. Most of the gateways were located in totality concept redoubts, subterranean military complexes scattered over the face of America. Even during the height of the totality concept researches, only a handful of people knew the redoubts even existed, and only half a handful knew all their locations. The knowledge had been lost after the nuke cost, rediscovered a century later, then jealously, ruthlessly guarded. There were, however, gateway units in other countries: Russia, Mongolia, Tibet, England, South America. But not all installations containing a gateway were connected to the totality concept. The gateways mass-produced as modular units were sent all over the world. Not even Lakesh knew how many were manufactured or to where they were shipped. Kane bowed and made an elaborate after-you gesture.
Find a seat, if you've a mind to, Miss Singh.
Tanvira didn't move.
So this is where the Consolidation War, the final war, began.
Kane regarded Tanvira with a slit-eyed glare, but he didn't refute her. In most ways, the important ways, she was right, even though her definition of final war was open to challenge. It had been almost 29 years since Sam, the so-called Imperator, had first appeared and factionalized the Nine Barons, and, in the process, brought a new order to the face of the world. The ancient Roman Empire was governed by a Senate, but ruled by an Emperor, sometimes known as an Imperator. During a Council of the Barons in Front Royal, Baron Cobalt put forth the proposal to establish a central ruling consortium. In effect, the barons would become viceroys, plenipotentiaries in their own territories. They were accustomed to acting as the viceroys of the Archon Directorate, so the actual proposal didn't offend them. The barons were less in favor of Baron Cobalt's proposal than of his intent to be recognized as the Imperator. However, they really didn't have much of a choice. Cobalt had established a monopoly over the medical treatments the barons needed to reverse their autoimmune weaknesses and stay alive. Although all the hybrids were extremely long-lived, cellular and metabolic deterioration was part and parcel of what they were, hybrids of human and Archon DNA. When Baron Cobalt dangled the medical treatments before his fellow barons like a carrot on a stick rather than sharing them freely, war was the inevitable result, particularly after Sam hijacked not only Cobalt's plan, but the title of Imperator. A series of battles began, known as the Imperator Wars. The conflict was short-lived and ended with the siege of Cobaltville and the ousting of its baron. But peace didn't come with the imposition of imperial rule. To the contrary, it sparked dozens of smaller wars and a succession of plots and counterplots. The Cerberus exiles weren't oblivious to these machinations, occurring in the Outlands and in the Vills, but they weren't particularly disturbed by them either. Baron Cobalt, the only hybrid lord who bore Cerberus a personal grudge, was missing and presumed dead. Sam, the Imperator, was fixated on unification, as the Barons were, but with a different objective. His stated intent was to end the tyranny of the Barons and unify both hybrid and human and build a new Earth. In the months following his appearance, the entire structure of the baronies changed. He made considerable inroads into toppling the old order and enfranchising his forces, even though not all the Barons supported him. The general consensus among the Cerberus staff was that even the Barons who withheld their support wouldn't undertake organized resistance against him. Even if all the baronies united against the Imperator, it would require months to prepare any kind of military campaign, and they had to do so in secret, else they would not have access to the medical treatments. For a short time, an uneasy peace prevailed. However, Cobalt wasn't dead. No one really knew where he had been or why he hadn't died when his metabolic treatments were discontinued. But he had been setting the stage for a major winner-take-all confrontation between the Imperator and his allies and the disenfranchised Barons. Cobalt viewed Cerberus as a wild card that needed to be dealt out of the equation before Sam could be challenged. The vengeful Baron and his anti-imperial forces did just that by essentially neutralizing the redoubt, destroying the majority of its personnel and the advanced tech available to them. The battle raged for less than an hour, and the plateau literally became sodden with blood, spilled by defender and attacker alike. Kane remembered with startling clarity how for one glorious moment after Philboyd crashed the Manta Tav into the Deathbird, the Cerberus warriors swept the plateau clear of black-armored magistrates. But the Mags regrouped and charged forward and swarmed into the redoubt. Even after nearly 30 years, Kane felt a surge of pride at the memory of how the people fought back with anything they could get their hands on. They shot, hacked, and stabbed until they themselves were shot, hacked, and stabbed. No one gave up, not even the few personnel Kane had once contemptuously dismissed as cowardly teeks, technical geeks. There were survivors, of course. Grant, Brigid Baptiste, Bry, Lakesh, and a handful of moonbase emigres. They had no choice but to join the Imperator in his China stronghold. Even before the smoke had cleared from the Cerberus battlefield, they planned and launched the first counterattacks against the Barons that became known as the Consolidation War. By harnessing the energies of the heart of the world, Sam implemented a long-range strategy that eventually culminated in the systematic and utter destruction of everything baronial. The Consolidation War was won by the sheer determination of the newly formed Consolidated Confederation of States. By war's end, 3 years later, the armies of the Barons were not only broken and scattered to the four winds, but the entire feudal system of god-kings was dismantled. Thus, America was united again. But soon afterward, there were rumblings of new threats, new menaces to the hard-won peace. Kane couldn't help but suspect these new enemies were manufactured to keep him and a few others from turning their attention to the unresolved questions of the Battle of Cerberus. When he felt the hand clap onto his shoulder, Kane whirled, instinctively raising his arms to draw his katana. Tanvira recoiled from him, fear registering on her face. He felt his own face contort in a silent lupine snarl.
I didn't mean to startle you. I asked you a question and you didn't answer me, so I...
Never mind. I get preoccupied sometimes. Guess it has something to do with my age.
She nodded in understanding.
My dad drifts off too once in a while. I've seen him crying when he thinks nobody is looking. I've heard him say Domi. Do you remember her?
Kane felt his chest clench in a painful spasm.
Yes. She died on the day Cerberus was attacked, trying to save a woman and her unborn child.
Tanvira said nothing, but her long, sweeping lashes veiled her eyes for a moment. Kane unbuckled his scabbarded sword.
What were you asking me?
I wanted to know if I could take a look at that gateway unit, make sure it's operating.
Kane looked hesitantly at Tanvira.
I won't break it, if that's what you're worried about. Dad gave me training in its hardware.
I'm not concerned about you damaging it. I've been using it for something a little different than hyperdimensional travel, and I don't want you to disturb its new settings.
We know the new settings. You've been trying to turn it into a temporal dilator.
Actually, I call it a spatiotemporal dissociator.
She raised a sardonic eyebrow.
You call it that?
Kane shrugged, placing his coat and katana on a desk.
To be precise, its technical name is the Sloan Spatiotemporal Dissociator. But your mom was pretty pissed at me when I stole the plans for it from her. When you get home, you can tell her we finally got the damn thing working.
Startled, Tanvira swung her head toward him.
We? You said you lived here alone.
Kane began walking toward the anteroom.
No, you said that. You want to meet my roomie?
The stamp of years and suffering accentuated the skull-like contours of the old man's face. Waxy, white, and deeply seamed, it was the face of a man nearing the conclusion of his life. He wore large, dark glasses with heavy rims. What little hair he had was no more than tufts of tangled, coppery curls. His frail, emaciated body was hunched over in a wheelchair. He wore a patched gray bodysuit that looked as if it had been stripped none too carefully from a vagrant scarecrow. The man grasped the wheels of his chair with claw-like hands and turned it. Behind the gray-tinted lenses of his glasses, his eyes darted up and down Tanvira's form with an aggressive intensity. She tried to meet his gaze with an intimidating one of her own, but his eyes didn't stop on her face. They continued flicking from one part of her body to another.
You're Lakesh's daughter.
Tanvira frowned at the accusatory tone of his voice.
I don't believe I've had the pleasure.
Kane tried unsuccessfully to repress a grin.
Meet Donald Bry, Tanvira.
Her shoulders jerked in reaction to his words.
Him?
She bent forward slightly, studying the wheelchair-bound man closely.
You?
Me.
I heard you were dead.
Bry's seamed face seemed to collapse in a network of wrinkles. It took Tanvira a moment to realize he was smiling.
Pretty damn near it, I can't deny. But I pulled through.
Tanvira struggled to regain her composure.
Mr. Bry, if my father knew you were alive, you would enjoy a high position in High River. He has often spoken of his deep respect and affection for you.
Bry's lips writhed as if he were either trying to laugh or to spit.
Yeah, that's why he was willing to let me rot in Scorpia Prime's stronghold, I suppose. Respect and affection.
He believed you were dead.
Bry's body quaked, his gnarled fingers flexing and unflexing on the armrests of his wheelchair.
Apparently he didn't give much of a shit one way or the other.
That's enough from both of you.
Tanvira turned her dark, furious eyes on him.
I don't think it is, sir. If Dad had any idea Mr. Bry was up here alive...
He would have arranged for his repatriation. It was fine with your old man for me to live up here alone, but not Bry?
Tanvira cast her eyes downward for a moment, then raised them to stare steadily into Kane's face.
That's not exactly how I would have phrased it, but yes.
I didn't want that fucking Lakesh to know I was up here. I never wanted to see him again.
He turned furious eyes on Kane.
What the hell is she doing here in the first place?
Kane quickly explained to Bry how Tanvira came to be in the redoubt. As he did so, she gave the Mattrans unit a swift visual inspection. Just as her father had described, on a small plaque above the keypad encoding panel, imprinted in faded maroon letters, were the words, "Entry absolutely forbidden to all but B-12 cleared personnel. Mattrans." Even Lakesh didn't know who the B-12 cleared personnel had been and what had become of them, though he had opined they had probably jumped from the installation after the nuke cost, desperately searching for a place better than Cerberus, and undoubtedly not finding it. Tanvira frowned at how the metal plate on the elevated jump platform gaped open, exposing the confusing circuit network of the emitter array. From the aperture stretched a web of fiber-optic cabling, terminating in a control console spanning the far wall. The console was crescent-shaped, surrounding a single operator's chair in the center. It bristled with thousands of tiny electrodes and complexities of naked circuitry, leading to a switchboard containing relays and readout screens. Below the console rested a small square generator bolted to a wheeled pallet. She guessed it was there to provide power to some secondary systems. Projecting above the inner horseshoe curve of the console, attached to a stanchion, revolved a model of Earth around 3 feet in diameter. The contoured surface showed rivers, lakes, and oceans in blue, forests in various shades of green, deserts in beige and light gray for mountain ranges. Cities were rendered in pale yellow. The carefully detailed surface was mostly beige.
So this is it? Your homemade version of a temporal dilator?
You don't sound impressed.
Should I be?
Bry shrugged.
This isn't the first time the gateway unit was altered to act as a time machine. Your father used the fundamentals of the quantum interface mat transducers to break through the chronon structure, utilizing the quincunx effect to its full potential.
Tanvira regarded him coldly with an over-the-shoulder glance.
It looks like you cobbled it together from odds and ends found in...
Tom Edison's basement? That's one of your father's favorite expressions. It got really tiresome.
The truth can be sometimes.
Kane smiled wryly.
Brian, your old man, cobbled this particular thing together many years ago.
For the Omega Path?
Exactly. So it's more than a piece of junk. It's an historical artifact.
Tanvira couldn't argue with Bry on that fact, even if she had wanted to. She retained very vivid memories of what her father had told her about the Omega Path program, his one attempt at temporal manipulation. Without access to the specs and data of Operation Kronos, Lakesh was unable to duplicate their accomplishments, so he decided to circumvent them. He saw to the creation of the Omega Path program and linked it with the Mattrans Gateway. The concept was sound. To dispatch Kane and Brigid back through time to a point only a month before the nuke cost, so they could hopefully trigger an alternate event horizon and thus avert the apocalypse. The Omega Path had worked, at least insofar as translating them into a past temporal plane, but they came to learn it was not their world's past, but another's, almost identical to it. Any actions they undertook had no bearing on their world's present or future. Lakesh could only speculate on what had happened and on the system of physics at work. Operation Kronos had functioned on the chronon theory, that time wasn't continuous but made up of subatomic particles jammed together like beads on a string. According to the theory, between each bead, each individual unit of time might exist in an infinite series of parallel universes, fitted into the probability gaps between the chronons.
It's an artifact that you've probably damaged beyond all hope of repair with your tinkering.
We followed Erica's specs.
As best we could, anyway.
My mother said it would never work. You can't recapture something that was. That's like lighting a candle and trying to get the same flame on the wick as the time before.
That's because you look at time from a single perspective, just like I was raised to believe. I've had to alter my consciousness over the last 15 years to be able to accept that the passage of time is like a perpetual motion machine, which depends a great deal on subjectivity.
Tanvira narrowed her eyes.
That's metaphysical claptrap.
We know Earth is in motion, don't we? We have measurable phenomena and reference points that tell us so. We are moving in relation to something else, the universe at large. But we can't feel Earth turning at 25,000 miles per hour, can we? We can't feel the fact that the world is going around the sun or that the sun is going around the galactic center. But we know it to be true, both subjectively and objectively.
So you're saying that since we're moving forward at the same rate of speed, we can't actually relate to time except as a subjective phenomenon?
Pretty much, yeah.
Tanvira shook her head impatiently.
Time is also relative to mass and velocity.
Which makes it exist as a continuum, a series of events running in a continuous stream from the instant of the Big Bang all the way to the future, when entropy catches up with it. The only way we can perceive separate moments of time, the events, is subjectively. We believe in the flow, ergo we have the flow. Remember what Einstein said? That the distinction between past, present, and future is only a stubbornly persistent illusion?
Tanvira gave the appearance of pondering Bry's words, but Kane received the distinct and uneasy impression she was only pretending.
So if you don't believe in the flow, then you can alter time?
Yeah, essentially.
Then what keeps you stuck in one place and one era?
The Cronon Wave. We're riding it, surfing it.
Think of humanity as a glob of mercury on a sheet of glass. It runs across the glass when we tilt it at either slow or fast speeds, depending on the angle of the tilt.
Tanvira cast her glance from the console to the model of Earth to the upright gateway unit. She didn't say anything, but Kane saw the unease flickering in her eyes.
None of this is really beyond your understanding. If you inherited even a fraction of your parents' IQs, everything we've said here must sound pretty childish.
Tanvira turned her face toward him, but didn't meet his gaze.
You're doing a poor job of pretending we're not onto something, and I'm going to assume the Naroda are onto something similar.
I admit it. The Naroda research dovetails with yours. They are trying to ride a time wave as well. But they intend to ride it over the edge of the sheet of glass Mr. Bry mentioned. And the edge is where time ends, the sum of all existence.
How can they do that? What tech are they employing?
We're not sure. And the equations they're employing are so esoteric that even I have trouble following them. Hyperdimensional physics depends on the directed acceleration and deceleration of subatomic particles, but they don't seem to have a propagation medium.
Then they'd have a singularity. And if they do, they don't have it working. Otherwise, none of us would be here to debate the possibility.
Tanvira nodded, but she didn't appear convinced or comforted.
What do you intend to do once your device is completed? Search through all of human history for the point at which to change the course of technical development and keep now from happening?
We've found that point already.
Tanvira nodded again, as if she had expected the answer.
So have the Naroda. And whatever method they're using would require enormous power. And there's only one place on Earth that has the power to harness the Cronon waves, and it must be secured. It's forbidden to everyone on Earth, except you.
Kane nodded, feeling not in the least victorious that Tanvira had confirmed his earlier suspicions.
Thunder Isle. But your news is old. The place is off limits, even to me.
Although she wanted to, Tanvira didn't protest when Kane took her on a short tour of the Cerberus Redoubt. She had seen vids of the entire complex, taped by her father before the assault. She knew about the machine shop, the nuclear-generated power, and the armory with its grenades, machine guns, and all the deadly toys men of Kane's generation loved so much. The installation was a mere shadow of what it had been, barely a rough sketch of the sprawling, bustling underground city of steel and glass as envisioned by Lakesh. Acceding to her request, Kane took Tanvira down the emergency stairs to the engineering department on the third level. Within a huge wire enclosure were three ovoid vanadium-shelled generators. If the central complex two levels above had served as the brain of Cerberus, the subterranean room was its heart, pumping life and power to it. Opposite the cage stretched a long operations and monitoring station. Although a few liquid crystal displays glowed, only a couple of needle gauges wavered. Only one of the generators still functioned. She knew that the reactor itself was buried an additional 100 feet below the engine room, beneath rock and shield concrete. Kane escorted her to the cafeteria, where so many briefings, planning sessions, and schemes had occurred. He gestured to the pair of big industrial-sized refrigerators.
You're welcome to look over our supplies, but I warn you, our menus are pretty limited. We used to trade food with what was left of Skydog's band, but they relocated a couple of years ago. They never were much into farming, anyhow.
Tanvira didn't request clarification about the people in question. She was at the point in her father's memoirs where he had gone into great detail about the band of Amerindians who had been the Cerberus installation's nearest neighbors, its only neighbors, for that matter. Direct contact hadn't been established between the redoubt's personnel and the tribe's people until shortly after the arrival of Kane, Grant, and Bridget Baptiste. Kane had managed to turn a potentially tragic misunderstanding into a budding alliance with Skydog. Not so much a chief as a shaman, a warrior priest, Skydog was Cobaltville bred, as they were. Unlike them, he had been exiled from the Ville while still a youth due to his Lakota ancestry. He joined a band of Cheyenne and Sioux, living in the foothills of the Bitterroot Range, and eventually earned a position of high authority and respect among them. Tanvira opened a refrigerator door.
Dad told me about the alliance you struck with Skydog and his people. What happened to them?
They were the first casualties of the war. Baron Cobalt ordered their extermination, so none of Skydog's people could warn us up here. He felt he owed them a massacre.
Tanvira didn't know what to say, so she opted to remain silent, although she mentally kicked herself for not remembering the fate of the Amerindians. Many years before, a squad of hard-contact mags from Cobaltville made an incursion into the Bitterroot Range as part of a Ville-wide cooperative effort. The squad's mission was to investigate the Cerberus Redoubt and ascertain if it was playing host to three wanted seditionists, namely Kane, Grant, and Bridget. The magistrates were stopped and soundly defeated by Skydog's band of Amerindians in the flatlands bordering the foothills. Grant and Kane were instrumental in the victory, although they managed to keep their involvement concealed from the invading mags. Tanvira found the makings of a simple salad in the crisper drawers of the refrigerator. She could think of nothing pertinent to say about Skydog.
Dad told me that you were very popular with the Indians, that they adopted you into their tribe.
That's true.
Tanvira knew that most of the people who had lived in the redoubt, with only a few exceptions, were Ville-bred, and they were accustomed to an artificial environment, particularly the moonbase emigres. Rarely did any of them stray more than 10 yards from the edge of the plateau. Her father had often remarked with amusement how Kane frequently complained of suffering from redoubt fever. He would requisition one of the vehicles to drive down the treacherous mountain road to the foothills, to Skydog's permanent encampment. No one had ever asked what he did down there among the Amerindians, where he was known and admired as Unktomi Shunkaha. It was a name the band of Sioux and Cheyenne had bestowed upon him, first conceived as something of an insult. It became synonymous with cunning and courage after he orchestrated the Indians' victory over a magistrate assault force. After remaining with the band for a few days, Kane would return to the redoubt, often dirty and disheveled, but always relaxed. Lakesh and others wondered if Kane had a willing harem of Indian maidens who always looked forward to a visit from Unktomi Shunkaha, but everyone knew better than to inquire about it. Tanvira shut the refrigerator door and carried the bowl of vegetables to a table.
Were there very many blue-eyed Indian children left in the wake of your visits?
She glanced toward Kane. Cold steel eyes looked back at her, unblinking and without a glint of emotion. She sat at the table and shifted her feet uncomfortably.
I apologize. Dad wanted me to learn absolutely everything about you I could.
And have you?
Tanvira forced herself to meet his gaze.
I don't know. You keep looking at me like a wolf about to devour a rabbit in one gulp. Frankly, you scare the hell out of me, sir.
The man's lips quirked slightly beneath his mustache in what she hoped was a smile. He turned away from her and went to a nearby table. He dropped into a chair and stretched out his legs, propping his feet up on another chair. As he crossed his ankles, she saw that hard glint in his eyes had softened somewhat.
Did what you learned about me scare you? Or have I only been scaring the hell out of you since we met in the flesh?
With her fingers, Tanvira mixed the lettuce, carrots, and what she hoped were snap peas together in the bowl. She pretended to be totally engrossed in the simple task, when in reality she was summoning all of her willpower to lift her head and gaze directly into Kane's eyes.
I don't care for your manner very much.
Most don't. I've had complaints about it before.
I don't like it.
What's there to like? Here's the way it works. You're the interloper here. The only reason you made it this far is because I allowed it. The only reason you're sitting there eating our food is because I allow it. And I can disallow it pretty much when I feel like it.
Shove your threats up your ass!
You apparently didn't learn as much about me as you thought. Otherwise, you'd know I don't threaten. I make simple statements of fact.
Tanvira had been warned by both her mother and father how infuriatingly contradictory Kane could be. But she still hesitated between letting him know about her outraged dignity or maintaining a relatively indifferent facade. She was accustomed to a certain amount of informality from her advisors and colleagues. She had never insisted upon the full rendition of imperial rights, even though she and her parents were certainly worthy of them due to their status. But Kane's deliberately disrespectful and casual manner showed her that no one had ever really been at ease in her presence before, even the lovers she had taken during the orgiastic Sati rites.
We were talking about Thunder Isle.
I don't know about we. I mentioned the place. That's as far as it went.
Tanvira ignored the jibe.
It's the only place where Operation Kronos technology was fully functional. You cannibalized that tech to build your own backyard time machine.
You seem to know a great deal about what I've been up to. How can that be?
My mother and father have reports of what you took from Redoubt Yankee on Thunder Isle years ago.
And I'm sure they told you I've been monkeying around with the Kronos equipment without understanding any of it, using the trial-and-error process.
When she didn't immediately respond, Kane arched a challenging eyebrow.
Didn't they?
Yes. Both of them told me how you tended toward recklessness.
A tendency. I can still be reckless, I won't deny. And it's a damn good thing, too, or you wouldn't be sitting there.
She rolled her eyes in frustration.
All right, all right. You saved my life, thank you. Thank you very much. Now, can we get back to what...
And the way I learned not to be reckless was through the study of any given situation. I studied the Kronos temporal dilator and read everything in Redoubt Yankee's database pertaining to it, particularly that written by Torrance Silas Burr. I'm sure you've heard your mother speak of him.
Tanvira nodded in grudging assent, but said nothing. Her mother, by her own admission, had been beautiful, haughty, and arrogant when she earned her Ph.D. in cybernetics and computer science at the age of 18. Before she was 20, Erica Van Sloan had accepted a position with the Totality Concept. In the vast installation beneath a mesa in Dulce, New Mexico, she served as the subordinate, lover, and occasional victim of a man who made her own officious personality seem mousy and shy by comparison. According to what her mother had said, Torrance Silas Burr was brilliant, stylish, waspish, and nasty. He excelled at using his enormous intellect and equally enormous ego to fuel his cruel sense of humor. He delighted in belittling and degrading not just her, but other scientists assigned to Over Project Whisper. The one scientist he could not deride was Mohandas Lakesh Singh, the genius responsible for the final technological breakthrough of Project Cerberus, which permitted Operation Kronos to finally make some headway.
The main thing I learned is that the nature of time is very, very difficult to handle. Change one major thing, you wind up with approximately the same mess you were trying to fix, or you make a worse mess. Change a bunch of small things in the hope it'll end up changing the one major thing, and you'll find out you've just shuffled probabilities around, not averted anything. The disaster, like the nuke cost, will still happen, only the causes and effects will be different. All the factors that contributed to whatever you hoped to change are still present in the timeline. Understand?
Tanvira nodded impatiently throughout Kane's dissertation.
Yes, yes. Causality, I understand.
Oh, really? Can you by any chance explain it to me, then?
What does it mean to you?
Causal law, conservation of energy, and mass-to-energy ratio involves more than continuous functions. A spatial and temporal discontinuity is entirely possible, just like Burr and your mother always suspected.
Tanvira pushed the bowl of vegetables away from her.
Possible, but not something that can deliberately be engineered.
Of course it can. That was your old man's whole thesis, the bones of his recruitment speech to me, Grant, Bridget, and Domi back in the day.
Tanvira knew exactly what Kane referred to, since her father had often spoken of that particular encounter, stemming as it did from a conversation with none other than Silas Burr nearly 2 centuries before. In the Dulce facility, Burr had confided to Lakesh that his staff had used the Operation Kronos technology to peep through a gap in the Kronon structure into a future date, January of 2001. They discovered that a nuclear holocaust had, for all intents and purposes, obliterated the world. That news was horrifying enough, but what was worse was that further peeping experiments had shown that not only was the Holocaust preventable, but it wasn't supposed to happen. Operation Kronos had disrupted the Kronon structure and triggered a probability wave dysfunction. They had created an alternate future scenario for humanity. Or so Burr had postulated.
My father didn't understand the nature of the continuum, the quantum field back then. Nor did Torrance Silas Burr. It wasn't until my mother...
She broke off when she saw how Kane's eyes narrowed.
Until your mother waggled her ass at Lakesh and lured him over to the Imperator's side. I still don't know who was the primary seducer, Sam or Erica.
Tanvira felt the hot flush of anger warming her cheeks. She was barely able to restrain herself from hurling the bowl of vegetables at Kane's head.
You're a stubborn fool, and an ignorant one. The continuum isn't as easy to distort as my dad once believed. The resilience of the Kronon structure was unknown to him.
But not to Sam, apparently. After deserting us here, Lakesh gave up on trying to correct the probability wave dysfunction.
Because he came to understand there wasn't one, you idiot! What happened was supposed to happen. There never was an alternate event horizon. Time and events moved correctly. We now have a world at peace.
Kane seemed to take no offense at being called an idiot. Tanvira guessed he had heard far worse epithets thrown his way.
I didn't much like the world before it was at peace, but I really dislike it now. And I know damn good and well it wasn't supposed to be this way. Whether the Naroda or Sam or the Archons are responsible, it will be changed.
Tanvira sat straight up in her chair.
You do want another war, just like the Imperator said.
Kane shook his head.
I'm not going to pretend that pre-Imperial Earth was a nice place. It was damn ugly. The cost in human suffering was enormous, but the so-called adaptive Earth the Imperator wants is far worse.
How can that be? What can be worse than annihilation?
There can be different degrees of annihilation, Tanvira. A spiritual one, with all free will bred out of humanity, the entire population changed into drones, adapted to fulfill various needs, and all of us working for a non-human overlord. That is worse than annihilation. That's what I intend to rectify with my homemade temporal dilator.
Let's stop dancing around the real issue, shall we? Even quantum physics has its natural laws. You can't go back in time and coexist at any point in the past where you already existed. So even if you found the temporal fault lines, there's nothing you can do to repair them.
A lazy, almost contemptuous smile played over Kane's lips.
Who said anything about me?
Kane refused to answer any more questions or continue the debate. He led Tanvira out of the cafeteria and down the corridor. He directed her to turn into the first door on the left. It opened up onto a wide, white-tiled shower room. Each of the six stalls was enclosed by shoulder-high partitions. Rad counter gauges were affixed to the walls beneath the shower heads. Outside of every stall were shelves holding folded towels and terry cloth robes.
You can use a shower. Both of us can.
Tanvira was too emotionally drained to even wonder if he was making a snide comment about her hygiene, or lack thereof.
This used to be DCAM. It's the only place in the whole redoubt where the plumbing still works perfectly. The other bathrooms are iffy.
He strode to the far end of the DCAM facility, unbuttoning his shirt as he went. Tanvira stepped into the tiled enclosure and peeled off her clothes, placing them on an empty shelf near the front of the cubicle. She turned on the faucet. A spray of water jetted from the nozzle, and she adjusted it so it was a needle-like rain. When the water was hot enough, almost at the tolerance level, she stepped beneath the flow. She used a liquid soap dispenser affixed to the wall to work a lather all over her aching body, even making a shampoo of it for her hair. Although her limbs bore contusions and a few abrasions, they weren't particularly noticeable on her dusky complexion. The entire room filled quickly with billowing clouds of steam, and she contented herself with luxuriating beneath the driving jets of hot water, letting them soothe the muscle ache. She reveled in them, turning to feel their impact on her breasts and belly, back, and buttocks. After a few minutes, she adjusted the faucet, and streams of cold, clear water gushed down and rinsed the soap from her body. She watched the water drain away, down into a natural limestone filtration system built under the redoubt. According to her father, once it passed through, and the chemicals, including the lilac scent, had been leached out, the water returned to the complex's water supply. Stepping out of the cubicle, Tanvira pulled on a long robe, glad to be rid of the dirty and torn bodysuit. The robe was of old satin and almost diaphanous. She removed the Uma stone from her clothes and placed it in the voluminous pocket of her robe. She started to leave Decam, but she heard a faint grunt, full of annoyed pain. She moved toward the furthermost shower stall. A naked Cain stood there, body glistening with water. His back was turned to her, and she winced at the mementos of past violence scattered all over his lean, long-limbed body. She saw the stellate scars of bullet punctures, the thin and jagged white lines of edged steel that had sliced into his flesh, and the swirling wheel of a long-ago burn between his shoulder blades. She repressed a shudder at the sight of whip tracings etched into his lower back, buttocks, and thighs. Her mother had told her how Cain had been cruelly scourged when he was a prisoner of the Scorpia Prime. Now he stood in frowning reflection, trying to peel away a blood-encrusted bandage from his right ribcage. He had reopened the wound in the process, and a thin stream of scarlet trickled down his hip and across his thigh. She started to turn away when Cain cursed again as the bandage finally came loose. Impatiently, he wadded it up and tossed it away with an angry snarl. As he reached toward an open medicine cabinet bolted to the stall wall, she glimpsed the raw wound on his side, a gaping cut surrounded by bruised blue-black flesh. As she gazed at the injury, he glimpsed her. He made no move to cover himself. His expression didn't change at all. Tanvira, feeling like a combination of voyeur and naughty child who had been caught sneaking a snack, stepped boldly into full view. She gestured toward the medicine cabinet.
Would you like me to help you dress that cut? I have medical training.
It's more than a cut. I think some of the intercostal cartilage has been ruptured. Yes. Thank you.
Let me see.
Cain raised his arms and held them high to each side and began a slow turn toward her. Tanvira, as both a student of medicine and a Shakti priestess, was not unaccustomed to observing the naked male body. But Cain produced a startling effect, evoking such a strong sexual response within her, she was both dismayed and enthralled. Tanvira's gaze of carefully calculated clinical detachment passed over his body. The way he earlier reminded her of a wolf returned to the forefront of her mind. He was built with a stripped-down economy, with most of his muscle mass contained in his upper body, much like a wolf. His musculature was long and flowing, like stretched-out bundles of piano wire, covered by a pale brown lacquer. The smooth symmetry of the lacquer was spoiled by a number of scars, one of which cut down from his almost hairless chest across his muscle-ribbed stomach to a couple of inches above his pelvis. The scar came to a stop just above his thick thatch of pubic hair. She tried to stop herself, but her eyes strayed down and paused on his penis. It was long and thickly veined, looking almost as sinewy as the rest of him. Despite his age and the scar tissue, Cain's body was that of the classic warrior, of the gladiator. She reflected that the ancient Romans built statues to honor men like him, and women murmured at their feet. Ashamed of her own frivolity of thought, Tanvira concentrated on efficiently cleansing the wound.